to the standard Big Bang theory, in which the bang is identified with a fleeting burst of rapid expansion. But if we think of the inflationary sprouting from older universes of each new universe as its own bang, then inflation itself is best viewed as the overarching cosmological framework within which Big Bang-like evolutions happen, bubble by bubble. Thus, rather than inflations being incorporated into the standard Big Bang theory, in this approach, the standard Big Bang would be incorporated into inflation. Inflation and the egg. So, why do you see an egg splatter but not unsplatter? Where does the arrow of time that we all experience come from? Here is where this approach has taken us. Through a chance, but every so often expectable, fluctuation from an unremarkable primordial state with high entropy, a tiny 20-pound nugget of space achieved conditions that led to a brief burst of inflationary expansion. The tremendous outward swelling resulted in spaces being stretched enormously large and extremely smooth, and as the burst drew to a close, the inflaton field relinquished its hugely amplified energy by filling space nearly uniformly with matter and radiation. As the inflaton's repulsive gravity diminished, ordinary attractive gravity became dominant. And, as we've seen, attractive gravity exploits tiny inhomogeneities caused by quantum jitters to cause matter to clump, forming galaxies and stars, and ultimately leading to the formation of the Sun, the Earth, the rest of the solar system, and the other features of our observed universe. As discussed, some 7 billion or so years ATB, repulsive gravity once again became dominant. But this is only relevant on the largest of cosmic scales, and has no direct impact on smaller entities like individual galaxies or our solar system, where ordinary attractive gravity still reigns. The Sun's relatively low-entropy energy was used by low-entropy plant and animal life forms on Earth to produce yet more low-entropy life forms, slowly raising the total entropy through heat and waste. Ultimately, this chain produced a chicken that produced an egg. And you know the rest of the story. The egg rolled off your kitchen counter and splattered on the floor as part of the universe's relentless drive to higher entropy. It's the low-entropy, highly ordered, uniformly smooth nature of the spatial fabric produced by inflationary stretching that is the analog of having the pages of War and Peace all in their proper numerical arrangement. It is this early state of order, the absence of severe bumps, or warps, or gargantuan black holes, that primed the universe for the subsequent evolution to higher entropy, and hence provided the arrow of time we all experience. With our current level of understanding, this is the most complete explanation for time's arrow that has been given. The fly in the ointment? To me, this story of inflationary cosmology and time's arrow is lovely. From a wild and energetic realm of primordial chaos, there emerged an ultra-microscopic fluctuation of uniform inflaton field weighing far less than the limit for carry-on luggage. This initiated inflationary expansion, which set a direction to time's arrow, and the rest is history. But in telling this story, we've made a pivotal assumption that's as yet unjustified. To assess the likelihood of inflations being initiated, we've had to guess the characteristics of the pre-inflationary realm out of which inflationary expansion is supposed to have emerged. The particular guess we've made, wild, chaotic, energetic, sounds reasonable, but it is a guess nonetheless. The bottom line is that we don't know what conditions were like in the supposed pre-inflationary realm, in the fuzzy patch. And without that information, we are unable to make a convincing assessment of the likelihood of inflations initiating. Any calculation of the likelihood depends sensitively on the assumptions we make. With this hole in our understanding, the most sensible summary is that inflation offers a powerful explanatory framework that bundles together seemingly disparate problems, the horizon problem, the flatness problem, the origin of structure problem, the low entropy of the early universe problem, and offers a single solution that addresses them all. This feels right. But to go to the next step, we need a theory that can cope with the extreme conditions characteristic of the fuzzy patch, extremes of heat and colossal density, so that we will stand a chance of gaining sharp, unambiguous insight into the earliest moments of the cosmos. As we will learn in the next chapter, this requires a theory that can overcome perhaps the greatest obstacle theoretical physics has faced during the last 80 years, a fundamental rift between general relativity and quantum mechanics. Many researchers believe that a relatively new approach called superstring theory may have accomplished this. But if superstring theory is right, the fabric of the cosmos is far stranger than almost anyone ever imagined. Part 4. Origins and Unification. Chapter 12. The World on a String. The Fabric According to String Theory. Imagine a universe in which, to understand anything, you'd need to understand everything. A universe in which to say anything about why a planet orbits a star, about why a baseball flies along a particular trajectory, about how a magnet or a battery works, about how light and gravity operate. A universe in which to say anything about anything, you would need to uncover the most fundamental laws and determine how they act on the finest constituents of matter. Thankfully, this universe is not our universe. If it were, it's hard to see how science would have made any progress at all. Over the centuries, the reason we've been able to make headway is that we've been able to work piecemeal. We've been able to unravel mysteries step by step, with each new discovery going a bit deeper than the previous. Newton didn't need to know about atoms to make great strides in understanding motion and gravity. Maxwell didn't need to know about electrons and other charged particles to develop a powerful theory of electromagnetism. Einstein didn't need to address the primordial incarnation of space and time to formulate a theory of how they curve in the service of the gravitational force. Instead, each of these discoveries, as well as the many others that underlie our current conception of the cosmos, proceeded within a limited context that unabashedly left many basic questions unanswered. Each discovery was able to contribute its own piece to the puzzle, even though no one knew, and we still don't know, what grand synthesizing picture comprises all the puzzle's pieces. A closely related observation is that, although today's science differs sharply from that of even 50 years ago, it would be simplistic to summarize scientific progress in terms of new theories overthrowing their predecessors. A more correct description is that each new theory refines its predecessor by providing a more accurate and more wide-reaching framework. Newton's theory of gravity has been superseded by Einstein's general relativity. But it would be naive to say that Newton's theory was wrong. In the domain of objects that don't move anywhere near as fast as light, and don't produce gravitational fields anywhere near as strong as those of black holes, Newton's theory is fantastically accurate. Yet this is not to say that Einstein's theory is a minor variant on Newton's. In the course of improving Newton's approach to gravity, Einstein invoked a whole new conceptual schema, one that radically altered our understanding of space and time. But the power of Newton's discovery within the domain he intended it for, planetary motion, commonplace terrestrial motion, and so on, is unassailable. We envision each new theory taking us closer to the elusive goal of truth. But whether there is an ultimate theory, a theory that cannot be refined further, because it has finally revealed the workings of the universe at the deepest possible level, is a question no one can answer. Even so, the pattern traced out during the last 300 years of discovery gives tantalizing evidence that such a theory can be developed. Broadly speaking, each new breakthrough has gathered a wider range of physical phenomena under fewer theoretical umbrellas. Newton's discoveries showed that the forces governing planetary motion are the same as those governing the motion of falling objects here on Earth. Maxwell's discoveries showed that electricity and magnetism are two sides of the same coin. Einstein's discoveries showed that space and time are as inseparable as Midas touch and gold. The discoveries of a generation of physicists in the early 20th century established that myriad mysteries of microphysics could be explained with precision using quantum mechanics. More recently, the discoveries of Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg showed that electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force are two manifestations of a single force, the electroweak force. And there is even tentative, circumstantial evidence that the strong nuclear force may join the electroweak force in a yet grander synthesis. Taking all this together, we see a pattern that goes from complexity to simplicity, a pattern that goes from diversity to unity. The explanatory arrows seem to be converging on a powerful, yet-to-be-discovered framework that would unify all of nature's forces and all of matter within a single theory capable of describing all physical phenomena. Albert Einstein, who for more than 3 decades sought to combine electromagnetism and general relativity in a single theory, is rightly credited with initiating the modern search for a unified theory. For long stretches during those decades, he was the sole searcher for such a unified theory, and his passionate, yet solitary quest alienated him from the mainstream physics community. During the last 20 years, though, there has been a dramatic resurgence in the quest for a unified theory. Einstein's lonely dream has become the driving force for a whole generation of physicists. But with the discoveries since Einstein's time has come a shift in focus. Even though we don't yet have a successful theory combining the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force, all three of these forces, electromagnetic, weak, strong, have been described by a single uniform language based on quantum mechanics. But general relativity, our most refined theory of the fourth force, stands outside this framework. General relativity is a classical theory. It does not incorporate any of the probabilistic concepts of quantum theory. A primary goal of the modern unification program is therefore to combine general relativity and quantum mechanics, and to describe all four forces within the same quantum mechanical framework. This has proven to be one of the most difficult problems theoretical physics has ever encountered. Let's see why. Quantum jitters and empty space. If I had to select the single most evocative feature of quantum mechanics, I'd choose the uncertainty principle. Probabilities and wave functions certainly provided a radically new framework, but it's the uncertainty principle that encapsulates the break from classical physics. Remember, in the 17th and 18th centuries, scientists believed that a complete description of physical reality amounted to specifying the positions and velocities of every constituent of matter making up the cosmos. And with the advent of the field concept in the 19th century, and its subsequent application to the electromagnetic and gravitational forces, this view was augmented to include the value of each field, the strength of each field, that is, and the rate of change of each field's value at every location in space. But by the 1930s, the uncertainty principle dismantled this conception of reality by showing that you can't ever know both the position and the velocity of a particle. You can't ever know both the value of a field at some location in space and how quickly the field value is changing. Quantum uncertainty forbids it. As we discussed in the last chapter, This quantum uncertainty ensures that the micro-world is a turbulent and jittery realm. Earlier, we focused on uncertainty-induced quantum jitters for the inflaton field. But quantum uncertainty applies to all fields. The electromagnetic field, the strong and weak nuclear force fields, and the gravitational field are all subject to frenzied quantum jitters on microscopic scales. In fact, these field jitters exist even in space you'd normally think of as empty, space that would seem to contain no matter and no fields. This is an idea of critical importance, but if you haven't encountered it previously, it's natural to be puzzled. If a region of space contains nothing, if it's a vacuum, doesn't that mean there's nothing to jitter? Well, we've already learned that the concept of nothingness is subtle. Just think of the Higgs ocean that modern theory claims to permeate empty space. The quantum jitters I'm now referring to serve only to make the notion of nothing subtler still. Here's what I mean. In pre-quantum and pre-Higgs physics, we'd declare a region of space completely empty if it contained no particles and the value of every field was uniformly zero. Let's now think about this classical notion of emptiness in light of the quantum uncertainty principle. If a field were to have and maintain a vanishing value, we would know its value, zero, and also the rate of change of its value, zero, too. But according to the uncertainty principle, it's impossible for both these properties to be definite. Instead, if a field has a definite value at some moment, zero in the case at hand, the uncertainty principle tells us that its rate of change is completely random. And a random rate of change means that in subsequent moments, the field's value will change. It will randomly jitter up and down, even in what we normally think of as completely empty space. So the intuitive notion of emptiness, one in which all fields have and maintain the value zero, is incompatible with quantum mechanics. A field's value can jitter around the value zero, but it can't be uniformly zero throughout a region for more than a brief moment. In technical language, physicists say that fields undergo vacuum fluctuations. The random nature of vacuum field fluctuations ensures that in all but the most microscopic of regions, there are as many up jitters as down, and hence they average out to zero. Much as a marble surface appears perfectly smooth to the naked eye, even though an electron microscope reveals that it's jagged on minuscule scales. Nevertheless, even though we can't see them directly, more than half a century ago, the reality of quantum field jitters, even in empty space, was conclusively established through a simple yet profound discovery. In 1948, the Dutch physicist Hendrik Casimir figured out how vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field could be experimentally detected. Quantum theory says that the jitters of the electromagnetic field in empty space will take on a variety of shapes, from longer to shorter fluctuations. Casimir's breakthrough was to realize that by placing two ordinary metal plates in an otherwise empty region, he could induce a subtle modification to these vacuum field jitters. Namely, the quantum equations show that in the region between the plates, there will be fewer fluctuations. Only those electromagnetic field fluctuations whose values vanish at the location of each plate are allowed. Casimir analyzed the implications of this reduction in field jitters and found something extraordinary. Much as a reduction in the amount of air in a region creates a pressure imbalance, for example, at high altitude, you can feel the thinner air exerting less pressure on the outside of your eardrums. The reduction in quantum field jitters between the plates also yields a pressure imbalance. The quantum field jitters between the plates become a bit weaker than those outside the plates, and this imbalance drives the plates toward each other. Think about how thoroughly odd this is. you place two plain, ordinary, uncharged metal plates into an empty region of space facing one another. As their masses are tiny, the gravitational attraction between them is so small that it can be completely ignored. Since there is nothing else around, you naturally conclude that the plates will stay put. But this is not what Casimir's calculations predicted would happen. He concluded that the plates would be gently guided by the ghostly grip of quantum vacuum fluctuations to move toward one another. When Casimir first announced these theoretical results, equipment sensitive enough to test his predictions didn't exist. Yet within about a decade, another Dutch physicist, Marcus Barney, was able to initiate the first rudimentary tests of this Casimir force, and increasingly precise experiments have been carried out ever since. In 1997, for example, Steve Lamoureux, then at the University of Washington, confirmed Casimir's predictions to an accuracy of 5%. For plates roughly the size of playing cards, and placed 1/10,000th of a centimeter apart, the force between them is about equal to the weight of a single teardrop. This shows how challenging it is to measure the Casimir force. There is now little doubt that the intuitive notion of empty space as a static, calm, eventless arena is thoroughly off base. Because of quantum uncertainty, empty space is teeming with quantum activity. It took scientists the better part of the 20th century to fully develop the mathematics for describing such quantum activity of the electromagnetic and strong and weak nuclear forces. The effort was well spent. Calculations using this mathematical framework agree with experimental findings to an unparalleled precision. For example, calculations of the effect of vacuum fluctuations on the magnetic properties of electrons agree with experimental results to one part in a billion. Yet, despite all this success, for many decades, physicists have been aware that quantum jitters have been fomenting discontent within the laws of physics. Jitters and their discontent. So far, we've discussed only quantum jitters for fields that exist within space. What about the quantum jitters of space itself? While this might sound mysterious, it's actually just another example of quantum field jitters. An example, however, that proves particularly troublesome. In the general theory of relativity, Einstein established that the gravitational force can be described by warps and curves in the fabric of space. He showed that gravitational fields manifest themselves through the shape or geometry of space, and of space-time more generally. Now, just like any other field, the gravitational field is subject to quantum jitters. The uncertainty principle ensures that over tiny distance scales, the gravitational field fluctuates up and down. And, since the gravitational field is synonymous with the shape of space, such quantum jitters mean that the shape of space fluctuates randomly. Again, as with all examples of quantum uncertainty, on everyday distance scales, the jitters are too small to be sensed directly, and the surrounding environment appears smooth, placid, and predictable. But the smaller the scale of observation, the larger the uncertainty, and the more tumultuous the quantum fluctuations become. This is illustrated by using several imaginary magnifying glasses, each of which magnifies between 10 million and 100 million times, in which we sequentially magnify the fabric of space to reveal its structure at ever smaller distances. At the lowermost level of magnification, which shows the quantum undulations of space on familiar scales, there's nothing to see. The undulations are unobservably small, so space appears calm and flat. But as we home in by sequentially magnifying the region, we see that the undulations of space get increasingly frenetic. By the highest level of magnification, which shows the fabric of space on scales smaller than the Planck length, a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth, 10^-33rd power, of a centimeter, space becomes a seething, boiling cauldron of frenzied fluctuations. As this makes clear, the usual notions of left-right, back-forth, and up-down become so jumbled by the ultra-microscopic tumult that they lose all meaning. Even the usual notion of before-after, which we've been illustrating by sequential spatial slices in the space-time loaf, is rendered meaningless by quantum fluctuations on timescales shorter than the Planck time, about 1/10 of a millionth, of a trillionth, of a trillionth, of a trillionth, 10^-43rd power, of a second, which is roughly the time it takes light to travel a Planck length. Like a blurry photograph, the wild undulations make it impossible to distinguish one time slice from another unambiguously when the time interval between them becomes shorter than the Planck time. The upshot is that on scales shorter than Planck distances and durations, quantum uncertainty renders the fabric of the cosmos so twisted and distorted that the usual conceptions of space and time are no longer applicable. While exotic in detail, this broad-brush lesson is one with which we are already familiar. Concepts and conclusions relevant on one scale may not be applicable on all scales. This is a key principle in physics, and one that we encounter repeatedly even in far more prosaic contexts. Take a glass of water. Describing the water as a smooth, uniform liquid is both useful and relevant on everyday scales, but it's an approximation that breaks down if we analyze the water with submicroscopic precision. On tiny scales, the smooth image gives way to a completely different framework of widely separated molecules and atoms. Similarly, Einstein's conception of a smooth, gently curving, geometrical space and time, although powerful and accurate for describing the universe on large scales, breaks down if we analyze the universe at extremely short distance and time scales. Physicists believe that, as with water, the smooth portrayal of space and time is an approximation that gives way to another, more fundamental framework when considered on ultra-microscopic scales. What that framework is, what constitutes the molecules and atoms of space and time, is a question currently being pursued with great vigor. It has yet to be resolved. Even so, what is thoroughly clear is that on tiny scales, the smooth character of space and time envisioned by general relativity locks horns with the frantic, jittery character of quantum mechanics. The core principle of Einstein's general relativity, that space and time form a gently curving geometrical shape, runs smack into the core principle of quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle, which implies a wild, tumultuous, turbulent environment on the tiniest of scales. The violent clash between the central ideas of general relativity and quantum mechanics has made meshing the two theories one of the most difficult challenges physicists have encountered during the last 80 years. Does it matter? In practice, the incompatibility between general relativity and quantum mechanics rears its head in a very specific way. If you use the combined equations of general relativity and quantum mechanics, they almost always yield one answer: infinity. And that's a problem. It's nonsense. Experimenters never measure an infinite amount of anything. Dials never spin around to infinity. Meters never reach infinity. Calculators never register infinity. Almost always, an infinite answer is meaningless. All it tells us is that the equations of general relativity and quantum mechanics, when merged, go haywire. Notice that this is quite unlike the tension between special relativity and quantum mechanics that came up in our discussion of quantum non-locality in Chapter 4. There we found that reconciling the tenets of special relativity, in particular the symmetry among all constant velocity observers, with the behavior of entangled particles requires a more complete understanding of the quantum measurement problem than has so far been attained. But this incompletely resolved issue does not result in mathematical inconsistencies or in equations that yield nonsensical answers. To the contrary, the combined equations of special relativity and quantum mechanics have been used to make the most precisely confirmed predictions in the history of science. The quiet tension between special relativity and quantum mechanics points to an area in need of further theoretical development, but it has hardly any impact on their combined predictive power. Not so with the explosive union between general relativity and quantum mechanics, in which all predictive power is lost. Nevertheless, you can still ask whether the incompatibility between general relativity and quantum mechanics really matters. Sure, the combined equations may result in nonsense, but when do you ever really need to use them together? Years of astronomical observations have shown that general relativity describes the macro world of stars, galaxies, and even the entire expanse of the cosmos with impressive accuracy. Decades of experiments have confirmed that quantum mechanics does the same for the micro world of molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. Since each theory works wonders in its own domain, why worry about combining them? Why not keep them separate? Why not use general relativity for things that are large and massive, quantum mechanics for things that are tiny and light, and celebrate humankind's impressive achievement of successfully understanding such a wide range of physical phenomena? As a matter of fact, this is what most physicists have done since the early decades of the 20th century, and there's no denying that it's been a distinctly fruitful approach. The progress science has made by working in this disjointed framework is impressive. All the same, there are a number of reasons why the antagonism between general relativity and quantum mechanics must be reconciled. Here are two. First, at a gut level, it is hard to believe that the deepest understanding of the universe consists of an uneasy union between two powerful theoretical frameworks that are mutually incompatible. It's not as though the universe comes equipped with a line in the sand separating things that are properly described by quantum mechanics from things properly described by general relativity. Dividing the universe into two separate realms seems both artificial and clumsy. To many, this is evidence that there must be a deeper, unified truth that overcomes the rift between general relativity and quantum mechanics, and that can be applied to everything. We have one universe, and therefore many strongly believe we should have one theory. Second, although most things are either big and heavy or small and light, and therefore as a practical matter, can be described using general relativity or quantum mechanics, this is not true of all things. Black holes provide a good example. According to general relativity, all the matter that makes up a black hole is crushed together at a single minuscule point at the black hole's center. This makes the center of a black hole both enormously massive and incredibly tiny, and hence it falls on both sides of the purported divide. We need to use general relativity because the large mass creates a substantial gravitational field. And we also need to use quantum mechanics because all the mass is squeezed to a tiny size. But in combination, the equations break down. So no one has been able to determine what happens right at the center of a black hole. That's a good example. But if you're a real skeptic, you might still wonder whether this is something that should keep anyone up at night. Since we can't see inside a black hole unless we jump in, and moreover, were we to jump in, we wouldn't be able to report our observations back to the outside world, our incomplete understanding of the black hole's interior may not strike you as particularly worrisome. For physicists, though, the existence of a realm in which the known laws of physics break down, no matter how esoteric the realm might seem, throws up red flags. If the known laws of physics break down under any circumstances, It is a clear signal that we have not reached the deepest possible understanding. After all, the universe works. As far as we can tell, the universe does not break down. The correct theory of the universe should, at the very least, meet the same standard. Well, that surely seems reasonable. But for my money, the full urgency of the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics is revealed only through another example. We have made great strides in piecing together a consistent and predictive story of cosmic evolution. But the picture remains incomplete because of the fuzzy patch near the inception of the universe. And within the foggy haze of those earliest moments lies insight into the most tantalizing of mysteries, the origin and fundamental nature of space and time. So what has prevented us from penetrating the haze? The blame rests squarely on the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics. The antagonism between the laws of the large and those of the small is the reason the fuzzy patch remains obscure, and we still have no insight into what happened at the very beginning of the universe. To understand why, imagine, as in Chapter 10, running a film of the expanding cosmos in reverse, heading back toward the Big Bang. In reverse, everything that is now rushing apart comes together. And so, as we run the film farther back, the universe gets ever smaller, hotter, and denser. As we close in on time zero itself, the entire observable universe is compressed to the size of the Sun, then further squeezed to the size of the Earth, then crushed to the size of a bowling ball, a pea, a grain of sand. Smaller and smaller, the universe shrinks as the film rewinds toward its initial frames. There comes a moment in this reverse-run film when the entire known universe has a size close to the Planck length, the millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a centimeter, at which general relativity and quantum mechanics find themselves at loggerheads. At this moment, all the mass and energy responsible for spawning the observable universe is contained in a speck that's less than a hundredth of a billionth of a billionth of the size of a single atom. Thus, just as in the case of a black hole's center, the early universe falls on both sides of the divide. The enormous density of the early universe requires the use of general relativity. The tiny size of the early universe requires the use of quantum mechanics. But once again, in combination, the laws break down. The projector jams, the cosmic film burns up, and we are unable to access the universe's earliest moments. Because of the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics, we remain ignorant about what happened at the beginning and are reduced to drawing a fuzzy patch. If we ever hope to understand the origin of the universe, one of the deepest questions in all of science, the conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics must be resolved. We must settle the differences between the laws of the large and the laws of the small, and merge them into a single, harmonious theory. The Unlikely Road to a Solution. As the work of Newton and Einstein exemplifies, scientific breakthroughs are sometimes born of a single scientist's staggering genius, pure and simple. But that's rare. Much more frequently, great breakthroughs represent the collective effort of many scientists, each building on the insights of others to accomplish what no individual could have achieved in isolation. One scientist might contribute an idea that sets a colleague thinking, which leads to an observation that reveals an unexpected relationship that inspires an important advance, which starts anew the cycle of discovery. Broad knowledge, technical facility, flexibility of thought, openness to unanticipated connections, immersion in the free flow of ideas worldwide, hard work, and significant luck are all critical parts of scientific discovery. In recent times, there is perhaps no major breakthrough that better exemplifies this than the development of superstring theory. Superstring theory is an approach that many scientists believe successfully merges general relativity and quantum mechanics. And as we will see, there is reason to hope for even more. Although it is still very much a work in progress, superstring theory may well be a fully unified theory of all forces and all matter, a theory that reaches Einstein's dream and beyond. A theory, I and many others believe, that is blazing the beginnings of a trail which will one day lead us to the deepest laws of the universe. Truthfully, though, superstring theory was not conceived as an ingenious means to reach these noble and long-standing goals. Instead, the history of superstring theory is full of accidental discoveries, false starts, missed opportunities, and nearly ruined careers. It is also, in a precise sense, the story of the discovery of the right solution for the wrong problem. In 1968, Gabriella Veneziano, a young postdoctoral research fellow working at CERN, was one of many physicists trying to understand the strong nuclear force by studying the results of high-energy particle collisions produced in atom smashers around the world. After months of analyzing patterns and regularities in the data, Veneziano recognized a surprising and unexpected connection to an esoteric area of mathematics. He realized that a 200-year-old formula discovered by the famous Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler, the Euler beta function, seemed to match data on the strong nuclear force with precision. While this might not sound particularly unusual, theoretical physicists deal with arcane formulae all the time, it was a striking case of the carts rolling miles ahead of the horse. More often than not, physicists first develop an intuition, a mental picture, a broad understanding of the physical principles underlying whatever they are studying, and only then seek the equations necessary to ground their intuition in rigorous mathematics. Veneziano, to the contrary, jumped right to the equation. His brilliance was to recognize unusual patterns in the data and to make the unanticipated link to a formula devised centuries earlier for purely mathematical interest. But although Veneziano had the formula in hand, he had no explanation for why it worked. He lacked a physical picture of why Euler's beta function should be relevant to particles influencing each other through the strong nuclear force. Within 2 years, the situation completely changed. In 1970, papers by Leonard Susskind of Stanford, Holger Nielsen of the Niels Bohr Institute, and Yoichiro Nambu of the University of Chicago revealed the physical underpinnings of Veneziano's discovery. These physicists showed that if the strong force between two particles were due to a tiny, extremely thin, almost rubber-band-like strand that connected the particles, then the quantum processes that Veneziano and others had been poring over would be mathematically described using Euler's formula. The little elastic strands were christened strings. And now, with the horse properly before the cart, string theory was officially born. But hold the bubbly. To those involved in this research, it was gratifying to understand the physical origin of Veneziano's insight, since it suggested that physicists were on their way to unmasking the strong nuclear force. Yet the discovery was not greeted with universal enthusiasm. Far from it. Very far. In fact, Susskind's paper was returned by the journal to which he submitted it, with the comment that the work was of minimal interest, an evaluation Susskind recalls well. I was stunned. I was knocked off my chair. I was depressed. So I went home and got drunk. Eventually, his paper and the others that announced the string concept were all published, but it was not long before the theory suffered two more devastating setbacks. Close scrutiny of more refined data on the strong nuclear force, collected during the early 1970s, showed that the string approach failed to describe the newer results accurately. Moreover, a new proposal called quantum chromodynamics, which was firmly rooted in the traditional ingredients of particles and fields, no strings at all, was able to describe all the data convincingly. And so, by 1974, string theory had been dealt a 1-2 knockout punch. Or so it seemed. John Schwartz was one of the earliest string enthusiasts. He once told me that, from the start, he had a gut feeling that the theory was deep and important. Schwartz spent a number of years analyzing its various mathematical aspects. Among other things, this led to the discovery of superstring theory, as we shall see, an important refinement of the original string proposal. But with the rise of quantum chromodynamics and the failure of the string framework to describe the strong force, the justification for continuing to work on string theory began to run thin. Nevertheless, there was one particular mismatch between string theory and the strong nuclear force that kept nagging at Schwartz, and he found that he just couldn't let it go. The quantum mechanical equations of string theory predicted that a particular, rather unusual, particle should be copiously produced in the high-energy collisions taking place in atom smashers. The particle would have zero mass, like a photon, but string theory predicted it would have spin 2, meaning, roughly speaking, that it would spin twice as fast as a photon. None of the experiments had ever found such a particle, so this appeared to be among the erroneous predictions made by string theory. Schwartz and his collaborator Joel Schurk puzzled over this case of a missing particle, until, in a magnificent leap, they made a connection to a completely different problem. Although no one had been able to combine general relativity and quantum mechanics, physicists had determined certain features that would emerge from any successful union. And, as indicated in Chapter 9, one feature they found was that just as the electromagnetic force is transmitted microscopically by photons, the gravitational force should be microscopically transmitted by another class of particles, gravitons, the most elementary quantum bundles of gravity. Although gravitons have yet to be detected experimentally, the theoretical analyses all agreed that gravitons must have two properties. They must be massless and have spin 2. For Schwartz and Schurk, this rang a loud bell. These were just the properties of the rogue particle predicted by string theory, and inspired them to make a bold move, one that would transform a failing of string theory into a dramatic success. They proposed that string theory shouldn't be thought of as a quantum mechanical theory of the strong nuclear force. They argued that even though the theory had been discovered in an attempt to understand the strong force, it was actually the solution to a different problem. It was actually the first ever quantum mechanical theory of the gravitational force. They claimed that the massless spin 2 particle predicted by string theory was the graviton, and that the equations of string theory necessarily embodied a quantum mechanical description of gravity. Schwartz and Schurk published their proposal in 1974 and expected a major reaction from the physics community. Instead, their work was ignored. In retrospect, it's not hard to understand why. It seemed to some that the string concept had become a theory in search of an application. After the attempt to use string theory to explain the strong nuclear force had failed, it seemed as though its proponents wouldn't accept defeat, and instead were flat-out determined to find relevance for the theory elsewhere. Fuel was added to this view's fire when it became clear that Schwartz and Schurk needed to change the size of strings in their theory radically, so that the force transmitted by the candidate gravitons would have the familiar, known strength of gravity. Since gravity is an extremely weak force, and since it turns out the longer the string, the stronger the force transmitted, Schwartz and Shirk found that strings needed to be extremely tiny to transmit a force with gravity's feeble strength. They needed to be about the Planck length in size, 100 billion times smaller than previously envisioned. So small, doubters Riley noted, that there was no equipment that would be able to see them, which meant that the theory could not be tested experimentally. By contrast, the 1970s witnessed one success after another for the more conventional, non-string-based theories, formulated with point particles and fields. Theorists and experimenters alike had their heads and hands full of concrete ideas to investigate and predictions to test. Why turn to speculative string theory when there was so much exciting work to be done within a tried-and-true framework? In much the same vein, although physicists knew in the backs of their minds that the problem of merging gravity and quantum mechanics remained unsolved using conventional methods, it was not a problem that commanded attention. Almost everyone acknowledged that it was an important issue and would need to be addressed one day. But with the wealth of work still to be done on the non-gravitational forces, the problem of quantizing gravity was pushed to a barely burning back burner. And, finally, in the mid to late 1970s, string theory was far from having been completely worked out. Containing a candidate for the graviton was a success, but many conceptual and technical issues had yet to be addressed. It seemed thoroughly plausible that the theory would be unable to surmount one or more of these issues. So working on string theory meant taking a considerable risk. Within a few years, the theory might be dead. Schwartz remained resolute. He believed that the discovery of string theory, the first plausible approach for describing gravity in the language of quantum mechanics, was a major breakthrough. If no one wanted to listen, fine. He would press on and develop the theory, so that when people were ready to pay attention, string theory would be that much further along. His determination proved prescient. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Schwartz teamed up with Michael Green, then of Queen Mary College in London, and set to work on some of the technical hurdles facing string theory. Primary among these was the problem of anomalies. The details are not of the essence, but, roughly speaking, an anomaly is a pernicious quantum effect that spells doom for a theory by implying that it violates certain sacred principles, such as energy conservation. To be viable, a theory must be free of all anomalies. Initial investigations had revealed that string theory was plagued by anomalies, which was one of the main technical reasons it had failed to generate much enthusiasm. The anomalies signified that although string theory appeared to provide a quantum theory of gravity, since it contained gravitons, on closer inspection, the theory suffered from its own subtle mathematical inconsistencies. Schwartz realized, however, that the situation was not clear-cut. There was a chance, it was a long shot, that a complete calculation would reveal that the various quantum contributions to the anomalies afflicting string theory, when combined correctly, cancelled each other out. Together with Green, Schwartz undertook the arduous task of calculating these anomalies. And, by the summer of 1984, the two hit pay dirt. One stormy night, while working late at the Aspen Center for Physics in Colorado, they completed one of the field's most important calculations. A calculation proving that all of the potential anomalies, in a way that seemed almost miraculous, did cancel each other out. String theory, they revealed, was free of anomalies, and hence suffered from no mathematical inconsistencies. String theory, they demonstrated convincingly, was quantum mechanically viable. This time, physicists listened. It was the mid-1980s, and the climate in physics had shifted considerably. Many of the essential features of the three non-gravitational forces had been worked out theoretically and confirmed experimentally. Although important details remained unresolved, and some still do, the community was ready to tackle the next major problem, the merging of general relativity and quantum mechanics. Then, out of a little-known corner of physics, Green and Schwartz burst on the scene with a definite, mathematically consistent, and aesthetically pleasing proposal for how to proceed. Almost overnight, the number of researchers working on string theory leaped from 2 to over 1,000. The first string revolution was underway. The First Revolution. I began graduate school at Oxford University in the fall of 1984, and within a few months the corridors were abuzz with talk of a revolution in physics. As the Internet was yet to be widely used, rumor was a dominant channel for the rapid spread of information, and every day brought word of new breakthroughs. Researchers far and wide commented that the atmosphere was charged in a way unseen since the early days of quantum mechanics, and there was serious talk that the end of theoretical physics was within reach. String theory was new to almost everyone, so in those early days its details were not common knowledge. We were particularly fortunate at Oxford. Michael Green had recently visited to lecture on string theory, so many of us became familiar with the theory's basic ideas and essential claims. And impressive claims they were. In a nutshell, here is what the theory said. Take any piece of matter, a block of ice, a chunk of rock, a slab of iron, and imagine cutting it in half, then cutting one of the pieces in half again, and on and on. Imagine continually cutting the material into ever smaller pieces. Some 2,500 years ago, the ancient Greeks had posed the problem of determining the finest, uncuttable, indivisible ingredient that would be the end product of such a procedure. In our age, we have learned that sooner or later you come to atoms. But atoms are not the answer to the Greeks' question, because they can be cut into finer constituents. Atoms can be split. We have learned that they consist of electrons that swarm around a central nucleus that is composed of yet finer particles, protons and neutrons. And in the late 1960s, experiments at the Stanford Linear Accelerator revealed that even neutrons and protons themselves are made up of more fundamental constituents. Each proton and each neutron consists of three particles known as quarks, as mentioned in Chapter 9. Conventional theory, supported by state-of-the-art experiments, envisions electrons and quarks as dots with no spatial extent whatsoever. In this view, therefore, they mark the end of the line, the last of nature's matryoshka dolls to be found in the microscopic makeup of matter. Here is where string theory makes its appearance. String theory challenges the conventional picture by proposing that electrons and quarks are not zero-sized particles. Instead, the conventional particle-as-dot model, according to string theory, is an approximation of a more refined portrayal in which each particle is actually a tiny, vibrating filament of energy called a string. According to this approach, each such particle is a vibrating string. A string is envisioned to have no thickness, only length, and so is one-dimensional. Yet, because the strings are so small, some 100 billion times smaller than a single atomic nucleus, they appear to be points even when examined with our most advanced atom smashers. Because our understanding of string theory is far from complete, no one knows for sure whether the story ends here. Whether, assuming the theory is correct, strings are truly the final Russian doll, or whether strings themselves might be composed of yet finer ingredients. We will come back to this issue, but for now we follow the historical development of the subject, and imagine that strings are truly where the buck stops. We imagine that strings are the most elementary ingredient in the universe. String theory and unification. That's string theory in brief. But to convey the power of this new approach, I need to describe conventional particle physics a little more fully. Over the past 100 years, physicists have prodded, pummeled, and pulverized matter in search of the universe's elementary constituents. And indeed, they have found that in almost everything anyone has ever encountered, the fundamental ingredients are the electrons and quarks just mentioned. More precisely, as in Chapter 9, electrons and two kinds of quarks, up quarks and down quarks, that differ in mass and in electrical charge. But the experiments also revealed that the universe has other, more exotic particle species that don't arise in ordinary matter. In addition to up quarks and down quarks, experimenters have identified 4 other species of quarks: charm quarks, strange quarks, bottom quarks, and top quarks, and 2 other species of particles that are very much like electrons, only heavier: muons and taus. It is likely that these particles were plentiful just after the Big Bang, but today they are produced only as the ephemeral debris from high-energy collisions between the more familiar particle species. Finally, experimenters have also discovered 3 species of ghostly particles called neutrinos: electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and tau neutrinos, that can pass through trillions of miles of lead as easily as we pass through air. These particles, the electron and its 2 heavier cousins, the 6 kinds of quarks, and the 3 kinds of neutrinos, constitute a modern-day particle physicist's answer to the ancient Greek question about the makeup of matter. The laundry list of particle species can be organized into 3 families or generations of particles. Each family has 2 of the quarks, 1 of the neutrinos, and 1 of the electron-like particles. The only difference between corresponding particles in each family is that their masses increase in each successive family. The division into families certainly suggests an underlying pattern, but the barrage of particles can easily make your head spin, or worse, make your eyes glaze over. Hang on, though, because one of the most beautiful features of string theory is that it provides a means for taming this apparent complexity. According to string theory, there is only 1 fundamental ingredient, the string, and the wealth of particle species simply reflects the different vibrational patterns that a string can execute. It's just like what happens with more familiar strings like those on a violin or cello. A cello string can vibrate in many different ways, and we hear each pattern as a different musical note. In this way, 1 cello string can produce a range of different sounds. The strings in string theory behave similarly. They too can vibrate in different patterns. But instead of yielding different musical tones, the different vibrational patterns in string theory correspond to different kinds of particles. The key realization is that the detailed pattern of vibration executed by a string produces a specific mass, a specific electric charge, a specific spin, and so on. The specific list of properties, that is, which distinguish 1 kind of particle from another. A string vibrating in 1 particular pattern might have the properties of an electron, while a string vibrating in a different pattern might have the properties of an up quark, a down quark, or any of the other particle species. It is not that an electron string makes up an electron, or an up quark string makes up an up quark, or a down quark string makes up a down quark. Instead, the single species of string can account for a great variety of particles, because the string can execute a great variety of vibrational patterns. As you can see, this represents a potentially giant step toward unification. If string theory is correct, the head-spinning, eye-glazing list of particles manifests the vibrational repertoire of a single basic ingredient. Metaphorically, the different notes that can be played on a single species of string would account for all of the different particles that have been detected. At the ultra-microscopic level, the universe would be akin to a string symphony vibrating matter into existence. This is a delightfully elegant framework for explaining the particles. Yet string theory's proposed unification goes even further. In Chapter 9, and in our discussion above, we discussed how the forces of nature are transmitted at the quantum level by other particles, the messenger particles, strong force gluons, electromagnetic force photons, weak force WZs, and gravity force gravitons. String theory accounts for the messenger particles exactly as it accounts for the matter particles. Namely, each messenger particle is a string that's executing a particular vibrational pattern. A photon is a string vibrating in one particular pattern. The W particle is a string vibrating in a different pattern. A gluon is a string vibrating in yet another pattern. And of prime importance, what Schwarz and Schurk showed in 1974 is that there is a particular vibrational pattern that has all the properties of a graviton, so that the gravitational force is included in string theory's quantum mechanical framework. Thus, not only do matter particles arise from vibrating strings, but so do the messenger particles, even the messenger particle for gravity. And so, beyond providing the first successful approach for merging gravity and quantum mechanics, string theory revealed its capacity to provide a unified description of all matter and all forces. That's the claim that knocked thousands of physicists off their chairs in the mid-1980s. By the time they got up and dusted themselves off, many were converts. Why does string theory work? Before the development of string theory, the path of scientific progress was strewn with unsuccessful attempts to merge gravity and quantum mechanics. So, what is it about string theory that has allowed it to succeed thus far? We've described how Schwarz and Schurk realized, much to their surprise, that one particular string vibrational pattern had just the right properties to be the graviton particle, the quantum mechanical messenger particle of gravity, and how they then concluded that string theory provided a ready-made framework for merging the two theories. Historically, that is indeed how the power and promise of string theory was fortuitously realized. But as an explanation for why the string approach succeeded where all other attempts failed, it leaves us wanting. Our concept of the subatomic